We ended the last show by mentioning the confession of Rudolf Hess, that confession that he made regarding the deaths of Jews at Auschwitz. In a sworn statement and in testimony before the Nuremberg Tribunal of April 15, 1946, he declared that between May 1940 and December 1943, while he was commandant of the camp complex, at least 2.5 million victims were executed and exterminated there by gassing and burning, and that at least another 500,000 died due to starvation and disease, making a total dead of about 3 million during that period alone. Although it is still widely cited as solid evidence, this confession is actually a false statement obtained by torture. Some years after the war, British military intelligence sergeant Bernard Clark, a Jew, described how he and 5 other British soldiers tortured the former commandant to obtain his confession. Hess himself privately explained his ordeal in these words. "Certainly," he said, "I signed a statement that I killed 2.5 million Jews. I could just as well have said that it was 5 million Jews. There are certain methods by which any confession may be obtained, whether it is true or not." Unquote. Even historians who generally accept the Holocaust extermination story now acknowledge that many of the specific statements made in the Hess confession are simply not true. For one thing, no serious scholar now claims that anything like 2.5 or 3 million people perished at Auschwitz. The Hess confession further alleges that Jews were being exterminated by gas in the summer of 1941 at 3 other camps, Belzec, Treblinka, and Walzec. The Walzec camp mentioned by Hess is a total invention. No such camp existed, and the name is no longer mentioned in Holocaust literature. Moreover, those who accept the Holocaust story currently claim that gassings of Jews did not begin at Auschwitz, Treblinka, or Belzec until sometime in 1942. We can go to John Beatty, who was a U.S. military intelligence officer and veteran of World War II. He wrote a book called The Iron Curtain Over America. Here's what he said, quote, "The figure of 6 million Jews killed by Hitler has been used repeatedly, but one who consults statistics and ponder the known facts of recent history cannot do other than wonder how it is arrived at. According to Appendix 7, Statistics on Religious Affiliation of the Immigration and Naturalization Service of the United States, which is a report of the Committee of the Judiciary of the U.S. Senate in 1950, the number of Jews in the world is 15,713,638. A corresponding item with the title, Population Worldwide by Religious Belief, is found in the World Almanac for 1940, page 129. There are 15,319,359. If the almanac figures are correct, the world's Jewish population did not decrease in the war decade, but showed a small increase of 394,359. Assuming, however, that the figures of the United States document and or the almanac are in error, let us make an examination of the known facts. In the first place, the number of Jews in Germany in 1939 was about 600,000, by some estimations considerably fewer, and of these, many came to the United States, some went to Palestine, and some are still in Germany. As to the Jews in Eastern European lands temporarily overrun by Hitler's troops, the great majority retreated ahead of the German armies into Soviet Russia. Of these, many came later to the United States, some moved to Palestine, some unquestionably remained in Soviet Russia and may be a part of the Jewish force on the Iranian frontier and enough remained in Eastern Europe to have returned from Soviet Russia to form the hard core of the new ruling bureaucracy in satellite countries. I got the following article from the American Free Press, dated December 23, 2013. It was an article written by Michael Collins Piper. He said that the Third Reich never once ordered the destruction of any book. The famous book burnings were not government-directed at all. They were entirely symbolic and quite limited in number, carried out by university professors, students, and intellectuals who were not among the strongest supporters of the new Hitler regime. No libraries were raided. No bookstores were sacked by jackbooted thugs. There were 4,175 titles officially banned by the Reich at one point or another over a 12-year period, but they were preserved in government archives. Under American occupation, there were 36,645 individual titles, plus every school textbook used in Germany from 1933 to 1945, which were officially banned by the U.S. Military Occupation Office of Information Control. Since the Americans did not want to be accused of burning books, just like the Nazis were accused, libraries, bookstores, and publishing houses were raided, and tons of books were pulped. General Robert McClure was in charge of the book pulping. He left the day-to-day decision-making up to his deputy chief, Russian-born Jew William Paley, a high-ranking Freemason and founder of the CBS broadcasting empire. He had the title of colonel, despite no real record of military service. Paley took time off from his media dynasty to direct the destruction of German literature and the arts. An Office of Information Control study by California State University's Dr. Cora Goldstein in the March-April 2008 issue of Military Affairs reported Office of Information Control's policy reflected the ideological profile of its staff and that a significant portion of the staff were New Dealers, intellectuals, emigres, Jews, and leftists. These were the creatures that were paid by the American tax dollars who conducted unquestionably the greatest campaign of book burning in all of recorded history. As you may recall, CBS was financed by Brown Brothers Harriman Bank, and one of its partners was Prescott Bush, father of the 41st President of the United States. 75% of the healthy POWs, the highest number of any World War II participant held by the Allies, died in captivity. This was a higher percentage of Germans who died under American supervision than Americans who died on the Bataan Death March. But we say Germany deserved it because of the gas chambers and the 6 million Jews they murdered. Remember, in 1939, Russia took half of Poland, half of Czechoslovakia, and Russia held most of Europe's Jews. There is no evidence that any Jews under Russian control in 1939 ever fell into German hands. Not a single one. In fact, the trainloads of Jews who were sent to labor camps went to the Urals to work for Stalin, not to Dachau. If you were to visit selected death camps where millions were killed by Germans and see the crematoriums, the gas chambers, and smokestacks, you will also find that they were built by Stalin after the war to demonstrate how the Germans did it. Of course, today, most know Stalin was the worst mass murderer in history. Why would he build demonstration gas chambers? The war with its greatest mass murder in world history as our ally gave Stalin the chance to hang his crimes on others, including some real whoppers. Stalin had Germans murdering tens of millions of Russian civilians, the same civilians who welcomed them as conquerors, hundreds of thousands of which joined the German army to fight Russia. After the war ended, the United States repatriated those civilians that left the Soviet Union with the retreating army, even though they didn't want to be repatriated. They were sent in boxcars back north to either be killed outright by Stalin or to be worked and starved in Siberia. This was referred to as Operation Keelhaul. And let us remember the Katyn massacre. The Russians claimed until 1989 that Germany murdered tens of thousands of Polish military officers after conquering Poland in 1939. It was called the Katyn massacre. Anyway, Katyn, the massacre, is real proof that bodies were exhumed, and it was lies for 50 years, and living proof that everything we heard from Stalin's Russia was a lie, and that it was Soviet policy to murder any entire population that he saw as a potential problem. Thus, of all the facts we base our beliefs on regarding World War II, the Katyn massacre is the most important. It is the smoking gun. Later, Russia admitted it had done it, killed them all, and blamed it on Germany. Thus, we reiterate, a person cannot legally challenge that Germany killed 6 million Jews in gas chambers because doing so is a felony in many countries. The only mass graves found tied to a Holocaust are Russian, not German. Remember when President Obama told us that his uncle had liberated Auschwitz, and then we found out he made it all up? Russia killed tens of millions and blamed about half of them on Germany. There were millions of Russians, over half the population of the Ukraine, which was systematically starved to death by Stalin. At the end of World War II, the Soviets found 9,000 American POWs in German camps in areas they liberated. What was done with the 9,000 Americans? They died in Siberia. Our own ally, the one that built the smokestacks at Buchenwald, the one that built the gas chambers there and sent 9,000 American prisoners of war to the Soviet gulags. Not a single one of them came home. Let's talk about Japan now. Before the war started, Japan was divided between two parties, the Peace Party, which had Emperor Hirohito, and several high officers in the Navy. The other party was the War Party, headed by Tojo, who thought Japan should control the Pacific Ocean and most of the lands touching it. For most of the Japanese, it was a war to defend their unique culture against Western imperialism. The atomic bomb made unnecessary the planned invasion of the Japanese islands, or so we were told. Such an invasion would have led to heavy casualties among Allied and Japanese armed forces and Japanese civilians. General George Marshall said that an invasion would have required 1 million men for the landing and 1 million more to hold it, and 500,000 casualties. This was not the opinion of many military officers. Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King said that in 1942 Roosevelt understood that by the application of sea power, Japan could be forced to surrender without the invasion of her home islands. The agreement on fundamental strategy to be employed in defeating Japan and the president's familiarity with the situation acquired at this time were to be of great value in preventing an unnecessary invasion of Japan, which the planning staffs of the Joint Chiefs and the War Department were advocating, regardless of the loss of life that would result from an attack on Japan's ground forces in their own country. MacArthur and Nimitz were now in agreement that the Philippines should be recovered with sea and air power then available in the Western Pacific, and that Japan could be forced to accept our terms of surrender by the use of sea and air power without an invasion of the Japanese homeland. A large part of the Japanese Navy was already at the bottom of the sea. The same was true of Japanese merchant shipping. There was every indication that our Navy would soon have the rest of Tokyo's warships sunk or out of action. The combined Navy surface of Air Force action, even at this time, had forced Japan into a position that made her early surrender inevitable. On page 245 of the book, I Was There, by Admiral William Leahy, who was Roosevelt's aide, it reads that none of us then knew the potentialities of the atomic bomb. But it was my opinion, and I urged it strongly on the Joint Chiefs, that no major land invasion of the Japanese mainland was necessary to win the war. The Joint Chiefs of Staff did order the preparation of plans for an invasion, but the invasion itself was never authorized. Japanese started sending out peace feelers as early as 1942 and continued to do so until the end of the war. The Battle of Midway, which occurred in June of 1942, was the turning point of the Pacific War, and most leaders of Japan knew it. After this battle, but before the invasion of Guadalcanal, this was in August 1942, an official of the Japanese Foreign Office delivered a highly confidential message to the interned British ambassador, Sir Robert Craigie. The message emanated from Foreign Minister Tojo and stated, quote, "Should it happen that the British government become desirous of discussing or negotiating peace, they would find the Japanese government ready to be helpful." On a PBS documentary, it was stated that in March 1945, our State Department received this dispatch from Japan, quote, "The Imperial Japanese government is willing to discuss surrender under any conditions the United States shall dictate." Was this an offer of unconditional surrender or not? The State Department did not forward the dispatch to the President or Congress because they said they had trouble with the translation. It was sent in English. They, the State Department, didn't forward it until August. How could they? Tokyo wasn't bombed until May the 9th and 10th. Nagoya got it on the 10th and 11th. Yokohama on the 11th and the 12th. All three cities were attacked not with explosives, but with firebombs. This was a holocaust. Tokyo was 90% wiped out in one night by the firebombs dropped on a paper city. The fire created winds up to 50 miles per hour. The atomic bomb dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima accounted for only 3% of the destruction of Japan. The Japanese death toll was larger in the combined firebombings of Tokyo, Yokohama, and Nagoya than in the bombings of Nagasaki or Hiroshima. More people were killed in Dresden than were killed in either Nagasaki or Hiroshima. Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal originated a plan to end the war with Japan 5.5 months before VJ Day. This fact did not become public until the publication of the book, The Death of James Forrestal, by Cornell Simpson in 1966. In May, the month Germany surrendered, Truman approved a peace ultimatum to Japan subject to the endorsement by the military. But on May 29th, General Marshall rejected it as premature. Japan was very much afraid that the Soviet Union would enter the conflict and bring Japan under the hobnailed boots of the Bolsheviks. Still, Japan even tried to sue for peace through Moscow. On July 12, 1945, Prince Konoye was received by the Emperor and ordered to Moscow as a peace plenipotentiary to secure peace at any price. Russia rejected the proposal. On July 6, 1945, a message was sent to the State Department by American diplomats in Sweden, which claimed that Prince Carl Bernadotte, nephew of King Gustav, had been told by the Japanese military attaché in Sweden that Japan had lost the war and wanted to enter surrender negotiations through the King of Sweden. Now the leaders of the United States had to solve a problem. How to keep the war going when Japan wanted to surrender? The spin doctors of World War II came up with a simple statement which became the rallying cry for continuing the hostilities. Unconditional surrender. This phase began under Roosevelt and continued under Truman. But not all who heard it agreed with it or could even understand what it meant. Senator White of Maine, minority leader, said, "The Pacific War might end quickly if President Truman would state specifically just what unconditional surrender means to the Japanese." Well, VJ Day was August 14, 1945. On August 19, 1945, an article was simultaneously printed in the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Times-Herald. This article came into existence through the Chicago Tribune journalist Walter Trohan. A military intelligence officer with access to classified information had given Trohan a copy of a peace proposal with the stipulation that he keep it confidential until the war was ended. Trohan kept his part of the agreement, and the article was not published until 5 days after Japan's surrender. The article had stated that General MacArthur had sent a communique to President Roosevelt in January 1945, stating that the Japanese were willing to surrender under terms which included, number one, full surrender of Japanese forces on sea, in the air, at home, on island possessions, and in occupied countries. Number two, surrender of all arms and munitions. Number three, occupation of the Japanese homeland and island, possession by Allied troops under American direction. Number four, Japanese relinquishment of Manchuria, Korea, and Formosa, as well as all territory seized during the war. Number five, reparations of all prisoners of war and interees in Japan and in areas under Japanese control. These were the identical terms the United States accepted from Japan when she surrendered on the USS Missouri on September the 1st, 1945. Roosevelt received the communique 2 days before leaving for the meeting with Churchill and Stalin at Yalta. He promptly rejected the proposal and told an aide, "MacArthur is our greatest general and our poorest politician." Shortly after General MacArthur's return to the United States from Korea in 1951, his neighbor at the Waldorf Astoria, former President Herbert Hoover, took the Trohan article to the general, who confirmed its accuracy in every detail and without qualification. So what would have happened to history if any of the peace overtures had been initiated, especially at the beginning or after the Battle of Midway? We would not have had to invade the Solomon Islands in June of 1943. There would have been no fighting in New Guinea in September 1943. Bougainville and Tarawa would not have come under attack in November of 43. The sound of exploding artillery shells, bombs dropped from the skies, the rattling of machine guns and the pop, pop, pop of rifles, or the screams of the injured and dying would not have been heard like they were heard on the Marshall Islands in January 1944. There would have been no loss of life in the Marianas in June 1944. Layat in the Philippines would have been reoccupied without a shot being fired in October 1944. Iwo Jima would not have had over 26,033 Americans killed or wounded in February 1945, or 39,000 American casualties on Okinawa in April 1945. We could also have saved many Japanese lives. The B-29 bombers dropped 1,700 tons of incendiary explosives on March 9th and 10th, killing over 80,000 people and destroyed 260,000 buildings. Of course, the atomic bombs dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima killed over 200,000 Japanese civilians. But Admiral William Leahy, Roosevelt's aide, said in his book, I Was There, quote, "It is my opinion that the use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. The Japanese were already beaten and ready to surrender. It is my reaction that the scientists and others wanted to make the test because of the vast sums that had been spent on the project. My own feeling was that in being the first to use it, we had adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages." Admiral Nimitz, General Eisenhower, and General LeMay asked President Truman not to drop the atomic bomb on a defeated enemy. Truman replied to an associate, "I'm not going to kiss their..." Well, you fill in the last word of this sentence. If we could have made peace with Japan without dropping the bomb, or even without being involved in the cauldron of the South Pacific, why did we destroy so many people and so much property unnecessarily? For the short term, it may have been to give the Soviet Union more influence and power over more territory. The Soviets were in the Pacific Basin for only 6 days. We hit Hiroshima on August 5th. They came into the fray on August 8th, 3 days later. Nagasaki was destroyed on August 9th, making the Soviets our effective ally for only 1 day. Japan is and was a country of diverse religions, and Japan was very tolerant of any religion. Nagasaki just happened to be the location with the largest Christian population. Was it just a coincidence that Nagasaki was bombed? Henry Hopkins, Roosevelt's closest advisor, probably had a lot to do with allowing the Soviet Union into the war. He had been an admirer of the Soviet system since the mid-30s. For their assistance, we gave them the rights to the ports of Daring, Port Arthur's naval base, several Japanese island possessions, and both Outer Mongolia and Manchuria, where huge stores of Japanese arms were stockpiled. These munitions were later transferred to Mao Zedong's communist forces, enabling them to carry on the war with the nationalist Chinese forces and eventually seize control of mainland China. Once again, time has caught up with us, but we'll be here again next week. Tune in then, won't you? Thanks for listening.